From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. Private sector innovation has transformed the American energy industry in recent years. A top federal official recently told a Raleigh audience what that means for our wallets and for world politics. A constitutional amendment on the ballot in November would change the way North Carolina fills judicial vacancies. You'll hear debate about the idea. The state treasurer reminds us why North Carolina needs to take steps to shore up long-term funding for government retiree health benefits. And we'll learn why North Carolina taxpayers continue to foot the bill for an expired renewable energy tax credit. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
New state education data shows that homeschooling is up in North Carolina, as is the number of kids who are enrolled in private schools. Now, that has analysts wondering a couple of things. First of all, why? And secondly, what does all of this enrollment data mean for the future of traditional public schools? Dr. Terry Stoops is Vice President for Research, also the Director of Education Studies for the John Locke Foundation. He's been digging into the data and joins us now. Terry, welcome back.
Thank you.
Let's talk about private schools first. What are we seeing in the data and what is the trend there?
Well, we're not seeing a whole lot of growth in private schooling. Year-over-year growth has it at 1.2% from 2017 to 2018 to 101,775 students in North Carolina's private schools during the 2017-2018 school year. So not a whole lot of growth, what we've seen in the last couple years. The real problem was after the Great Recession, there was a dip in private school enrollment, and only now are the private schools in North Carolina recovering.
Any chance that maybe that is sort of plateaued because we have seen increases in the number of choices and options in North Carolina that parents have?
I think so. And there may be some private school students who are homeschooling or going to charter schools. They may find that to be more appealing. And interestingly enough, we have voucher programs that provide public funds for low-income and special needs students to go to private schools, yet that doesn't seem to be driving the enrollment in private schools in any significant way. Now, we have seen an increase in the number of private schools we have in North Carolina, but the enrollment is largely flat, so we're not seeing voucher usage driving the enrollment for private schools as much as we might expect it to.
So a little bit of increase there for private schools, but the new data on homeschooling is really fascinating. Tell us what's happening there.
Well, a 6.2% increase from 2017 to 2018, putting the homeschool numbers over 135,000 students enrolled in homeschools. Now, unlike the private school number, these are just estimates that the Division of Non-Public Education derives from an algorithm. They punch it into a computer, the number of schools, and they calculate the number, an estimated number of students per school, and they come up with this estimate. There have been some that have argued, especially the homeschool movement side, have argued that this number actually underestimates the number of homeschoolers that are there. But I think it's a fairly reliable number, and we'll just go with 136,000 students. Because let's face it, that's really impressive.
It is. It's a big number. In fact, to help us compare, if the homeschoolers were considered a district, how would they rate in North Carolina in terms of size?
Well, they'd be the third largest district. And I'll tell you something, they're catching up to Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools, which is number two on the list. And of course, Wake County is number one on the list. And so I think we're going to see in the next few years, if this rate of growth continues, homeschooling perhaps becoming the second largest district, if it were a district, in North Carolina.
What I think is really fascinating is that for the longest time, it seemed as if the prospect of homeschooling a child was so incredibly daunting to a parent, and understandably so, that they would just say, oh, there's no way I could do that. But now we have more than 130,000 kids estimated to be homeschooled. Is there an increase in resources, or is it not as difficult as perhaps parents think? What's going on there?
Well, technology is definitely driving some parents to decide to homeschool with an array of online options, with curriculum being produced by multiple companies and entities out there. Parents have an unlimited supply of curricula and worksheets and instructional materials that they can use to homeschool their child. So that's a big part of it. But as the homeschool movement has grown, so has the use of cooperatives and groups of homeschoolers that come together and rely on the resources of the homeschool families that come together to perhaps teach that difficult course or to provide instruction in the arts that they wouldn't otherwise get at home, or they wouldn't otherwise get at home at the quality that they could get at a cooperative. North Carolina changed the homeschool law a few years ago to allow greater use of cooperatives. And so I think that's one reason why we're seeing some of the increased interest and enrollment in homeschools, because it doesn't seem as daunting as it used to be.
Do we have any sense of the typical demographic or characteristic of a homeschool child?
This is really interesting, because I looked at the makeup of religious versus non-religious homeschools. And in the year 2000, around 3/4 of the homeschools in North Carolina had a religious focus. This year, it was down to 58.5%. So what we're seeing is a dramatic decline in the number of religious-themed homeschools, and a surge in the number of homeschools that I guess we would call secular, but more likely don't have the type of religious focus and provide religious curricula like the homeschools certainly used to.
What's driving that?
Well, I think it's certainly a number of things. I think the homeschool movement has blossomed into one that has welcomed ideological, political, and religious diversity, frankly. We're not surprised to see now those from the center left start to homeschool because they're concerned about the public or private school that their child attends. So they find homeschooling to be a viable option. There's not the stigma that there used to be in homeschooling. And so I think that's welcoming a much more diverse group of parents into the homeschool movement.
So we've talked a bit about this slight increase in private school enrollment and this larger increase in homeschooling. What does all this mean for the traditional public school system?
Well, the traditional public school system enrollment has been plateauing for a few years now. It's probably one of the more underreported things in the media that we've seen large increases in homeschooling and in charter schools. But in the district schools, I estimate that there is going to be a slight decrease in the enrollment in district schools for this year, like about a half a percentage point is what I estimate. But the point is that districts aren't growing. Now, that may come to surprise some people that are in Wake County or in Mecklenburg County that are growing. But while those counties are growing, there are plenty of counties in other parts of the state that have a declining student population, and those are more than compensating for the growth we see in our urban and suburban counties.
Down the road, if the trend continues this way, then are we reaching a point where this could have an impact on, say, dollars needed for construction of schools or dollars needed to hire teachers?
Well, I think we're seeing that already. In Wake County, for example, has well over 12,000 homeschoolers. You think about what the impact of 12,000 additional kids would have on the Wake County schools if they had to build buildings for those for those students and provide teachers for them. So I think we've already seen the point where the number of students exiting the system is giving some relief to these fast-growing counties. Now, it's not eliminating the need for additional teachers or additional school buildings, but it's making a big difference. And I think that that's one of the reasons why you don't hear the Wake County School Board or the Charlotte-Mecklenburg School Board saying much about homeschools or private schools, because they're actually doing a service to the traditional system.
And lastly, Terry, how do we rate in terms of other states? Are they seeing the same type of trend, particularly with homeschooling?
This is tricky because a lot of other states don't actually produce this data. So we have really general and really unreliable estimates of what other states have done. If you look at the total number of homeschools, according to the estimate that I have seen, North Carolina has the third largest homeschool enrollment, which is remarkable because the other states are like Texas and larger states like that.
Terry, thank you.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at CarolinaJournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at CarolinaJournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at CarolinaJournal.com. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Innovation based in the private sector has helped improve America's energy picture. That's a key message from Deputy U.S. Energy Secretary Dan Brulé. He delivered that message during a recent speech in Raleigh for the Jesse Helms Center. Brulé began his remarks by quoting Helms.
One of the quotes that caught my eye when I was doing a little bit of background research to remind me was this one. He called our free enterprise system, quote, the miracle of America. And what a perfect description that is. When we embrace free enterprise, when regulations are simply the rules of the road instead of barriers blocking the road, something absolutely miraculous happens. We unleash creativity. We unlock innovation. We witness stunning breakthroughs in technology. And that changes everything. Nowhere is that more obvious or more evident than in the field of energy.
Brulé offered evidence to support his case.
Today, America produces more energy more abundantly and affordable, more cleanly and more efficiently, and from more energy resources than anyone could have ever predicted just a few short years ago. As a result of what we're seeing today, however, we are not only becoming an energy secure country, we are transforming our foreign policy. Indeed, energy revolution is the greatest boon to foreign policy since the collapse of the Berlin Wall, since the fall of the Iron Curtain, and since the demise of the Soviet Union. And as one who supported the policies that triggered those great outcomes, Jesse Helms would be enormously pleased if he were here today. The story of our energy renaissance and its effect on foreign policy is absolutely amazing.
Brulé turned back the clock to tell the story of recent American energy innovation.
The story actually began 40 years ago. And at that time, America faced price controls at home, oil boycotts that were imposed upon us from abroad, and cars that waited in long lines for a very short supply of gasoline. In his energy speech to the nation in April of 1977, President Carter reflected the conventional wisdom of his predecessors, and indeed that entire decade. He insisted that we were running out of oil and gas. He said we could not increase domestic production in any meaningful way. And even if new reserves were discovered, he and others believed that it was too costly to produce it or impossible to use it without, as he put it, plundering the environment. Perhaps he was related to Al Gore. I'm not really sure. Both Carter and his predecessors were absolutely mistaken. There was no shortage of energy. What we had was a shortage of vision. What we had was a loss of confidence in our ability to innovate.
That's Deputy U.S. Energy Secretary Dan Brulé speaking recently in Raleigh for the Jesse Helms Center. Brulé next pointed to the turning point in American energy policy.
So how did we get here? If we had that loss of vision, how do we get here? Well, part of the answer is yes, we began simply innovating. But before we could do that, we had to do something else that was big, and we did it. America had to fully abolish its price controls on energy. In a series of steps that was begun during Ronald Reagan's presidency, and it continued through the 1980s and the 1990s, the prices of oil and eventually natural gas were fully decontrolled. And once those price regulations were removed, innovation became profitable. And in the years and decades that followed, a number of states further ignited that progress, cutting taxes, simplifying regulations. State after state after state after state provided even further incentives to innovate. And with this innovation came a revolution in technology.
Brulé offered kudos to a state known for its private sector innovation.
The major breakthroughs that we are seeing today in hydraulic fracturing and horizontal drilling, which led to our natural gas boom across this country, began in the state of Texas. At the Department of Energy, in our national laboratories, of which we have 17, research and development helped not only to make this technology possible, hydraulic fracturing, but others as well, unleashing every energy source that America has. From fossil fuels to renewables, supply rose, costs fell, efficiencies increased, and energy diversity expanded. And as a result, the United States is now the number one combined oil and gas producer in the world. This year, crude oil production in the United States is set to be at our highest in our nation's history. We're now producing 10 million barrels per day. Next year, that's expected to go to 11. The year after that, 12 million barrels per day. Technological advances are driving the growth of renewables as well. From refrigerators to LED lighting, they're also increasing energy efficiency. And the same technology revolution is making our fuels even cleaner. From 2005 to 2017, we led the world in reducing carbon emissions, cutting them by 14% over that period of time. And we did it with innovation, without sacrificing our economy, and without the Paris Accords.
Brulé says the Trump administration and Congress have taken steps that will lead to even more benefits for the energy industry. That includes tax reform.
Cutting the corporate tax alone to 21% was absolutely revolutionary. It will reduce the cost of doing business. It will make America more competitive. It will bring American jobs home. It will encourage more innovation, more investment, and yes, more energy of every kind right here in America.
Regulatory reform helps too.
For every new regulation, this administration has removed 22. He's ended the war on coal. He's replaced it with strong support for clean coal technologies. He supported research and development on renewables, energy storage, battery storage, energy efficiency, and we seek to reinvigorate America's outstanding nuclear energy sector. Today, we stand on the cusp of energy independence, something I never thought that I would see in my lifetime. It means we no longer have to depend on the world's volatile regions for our energy. It means our energy supply is no longer insecure. It means our economy is no longer prone to skyrocketing energy inflation. It means we no longer have to fear boycotts from foreign suppliers. It means we no longer have to bow down to dictators. It means no nation or entity can ever hold our foreign policy hostage again for its oil. It means presidents can finally formulate foreign policy with their hands untied. It means they can base their decisions on what they believe to be best for our nation and its interests, its values, and its principles.
Brulé says there's a political advantage to the United States becoming an energy exporter.
By exporting our energy, we can liberate our friends and allies from dependence on unfriendly nations that wield their energy supply as a political weapon. We can strengthen the hand of friends like Ukraine, which is vulnerable to Putin's Russia. We can increase our own geopolitical influence in that process. And there's even more potential good news to relate as well. We can also import or export our energy technology. The same technology that unleashed the revolution here in the U.S., we can share with the world.
That's Deputy U.S. Energy Secretary Dan Brulé, speaking recently in Raleigh for the Jesse Helms Center. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation, and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Should the process of appointing state judges involve more than just the governor? State legislators think so. Republican Senator Warren Daniel recently reminded colleagues that governors have abused their appointment power. Daniel remembers when Democratic Governor Beverly Perdue, just before leaving office, appointed former staffers to the bench even though they had no judicial experience.
Governor Perdue is far from the only governor to do these things. Governor McCrory did it. Governor Hunt did it. Governor Easley did it. It has been done both by Republicans and Democrats, and it is wrong. It is a violation of the public trust. One person with no accountability picking judges is wrong. It creates all sorts of possible conflicts of interest and potential ethical problems. This process does not instill public confidence in the judiciary. But the current process has also been used to circumvent the will of the voters in duly held elections. Judges are often rejected by voters and then put right back on the bench by the governor. What's important is that we currently have a judicial vacancy selection process that allows a single person to potentially override the will of the voters in both local and statewide elections. That is why we need the Judicial Vacancy Sunshine Amendment.
Daniel says the amendment would not affect judicial elections.
The people of North Carolina continue to favor the right to elect their judges, especially at the local level. And two, our current system of selecting judges to fill vacancies is probably the most undemocratic, paternalistic process that we could have.
The new process would involve a new appointed committee to vet judicial candidates. That's not enough to convince Democratic Senator Jay Chaudhary.
The fact remains that the General Assembly ultimately controls and decides what nominees to recommend to the governor for appointment. This is yet another legislative power grab. This constitutional amendment will result in cronyism, partisanship, and backroom deals. And if you need an example, let's look at South Carolina, where as recently as 2000, every member of the South Carolina Supreme Court was a former member of the General Assembly. Now, I dare ask how many lawyer legislators in this chamber will now be appointed to the bench with the passage of the bill. This is not a judicial merit commission. It's a legislative appointment commission. And here's the result. We will see more members of the judiciary become a retirement home for former General Assembly members. And so, yes, our current system may not be a perfect one, but this amendment is an even more imperfect one. This bill claims to be called the Judicial Vacancy Sunshine Amendment, but the only thing that's vacant here is our sense of democracy.
Despite opposition from Chaudhary and fellow Democrats, the idea moves forward to North Carolina's ballot in November. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
We're doubling down on freedom. At Carolina Journal Radio, we're proud to bring you stories that impact your life and your wallet. And now, get twice as much freedom when you also listen to our podcast, Headlock, available on iTunes and at johnlock.org/podcast. Now, Headlock is a little bit different. It's a no-holds-barred discussion that challenges soft-headed ideas from the left and the right. But like Carolina Journal Radio, Headlock is smart and timely. But with Headlock, you'll hear more about the culture wars, and you'll get some more humor as well. We guarantee great information and a good time. Double down with us. Listen to Carolina Journal Radio each week, and listen to Headlock, too. Remember, you can listen to Headlock at johnlock.org/podcast, or subscribe or download each week at iTunes. Carolina Journal Radio and Headlock, just what you need to stay informed and stay entertained. Both brought to you in the name of freedom by the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Lots of interesting news involving the state treasurer's office, and that's why we bring in once again to Carolina Journal Radio State Treasurer Dale Falwell. Welcome back to the program.
Well, thanks for having me. And all across the state, I hear of people who get information off your show, so thank you for this service.
Well, one of the things that is of interest to everyone is rising health insurance costs. And one of the things that the treasurer's office has been involved with is having some benefit in that regard, dealing with Medicare Advantage. Tell us about that.
Well, the State Health Plan of North Carolina is the largest purchaser of health care and pharmaceutical benefits in our state. Nearly 720,000 of North Carolinians depend on us for health care because of their active or retired state employees. What we're trying to do at the treasurer's office, because we have a $35 billion unfunded liability that's right behind Illinois on a per capita basis that you report on occasionally, is that we're trying to take advantage of our largeness and sign contracts that benefit our participants, our retirees, and our taxpayers. We did that with our Medicare Advantage program. That these are our retirees over 65. The reason that there's not all of our retirees is there's no minimum retirement age in the pension plan, so people can retire earlier. But what we did is we renegotiated that so that this year we'll have a 30% reduction in our premium that we pay, and we're finished. There's no deductibles, there's no copays, and the state has no more medical exposure to these individuals based on this contract. Now, what we're going to do with that $55 million in savings is we are going to freeze, for the second straight year, family premiums for state employees. Now, that doesn't mean a lot to Roy Williams or Dale Falwell, but it means a lot to the beginning teacher, beginning trooper, beginning state employee who have to work 5 days out of every work month this year to pay the family premium. So we're going to at least freeze family premiums for the second straight year when everybody else's health care premiums are going up. We're going to look at an opportunity of actually reducing premiums. The reason we're doing this is this plane is right now in a nosedive. The left wing's down, the right wing's up, and the left wing is people my age and above. We have to attract younger, healthier people to stay health plan. We think by lowering family premiums, that's a good way of doing that. And even if it doesn't work, it's the right thing to do on behalf of our state employees. And it's all the result of taking advantage of our largeness, which is what we're doing in the state health plan and at the treasurer's office in general.
That's a pretty big, significant savings. It doesn't seem like that would be one that would be easy to achieve. Why has North Carolina not been able to do this in the past, come up with that big, big chunk of savings that you've just found?
Well, the biggest part of the savings came as a result of Congress putting back in the freezer something called the health insurance tax. I've talked to you on this show before. It's a tax that most of your listeners don't know they're going to get hit with. It's a premium tax on medical insurance policies. Your listeners are probably asking themselves, why is the treasurer talking about this? It's the state. It's a nonprofit. Why are they paying that tax? Because it does impact us. So about $42 million of that was a result of that tax being put in the freezer sunset for next year. I have and continue to try to get our congressional delegation, as well as President Trump, who I've personally written a letter to get this repealed for 18 also. So that's a part of it. But secondly, this contract has a profit-sharing arrangement, something else you've never heard of in state government, so that if these retirees are healthier than what the insurance company or even we thought they would be when we priced this, if the profit is over a certain amount, the state gets a 50-50 profit sharing with the insurance company. So not only did we lower premiums dramatically, we took advantage of our largeness, but we also have a profit sharing arrangement so that if our retired members are really healthier than we thought, then we get part of that money back also. That dovetails in really well with our watchdog mentality right now. Our only shot at curing this $35 billion unfunded health care liability is to turn these participants into watchdogs. But we have to give them the tools so that they can analyze the value and the price of health care. Because right now, unlike everything else that your listeners do, they don't consume health care in this state. It consumes them. And we're going to try to change that at the state health plan.
That is the voice of State Treasurer Dale Falwell. You have now referenced twice the big multi-billion dollar unfunded liability. And in fact, the first time around said that on a per capita basis, we're just behind Illinois. Mm-hmm. No one wants to be in that position. What other things are you looking at and do you want the General Assembly to look at to help deal with this?
Well, a lot of the things that we can do internally. Number one, we're coming out with an employee benefit statement that shows the true value of these benefits. As smart as they are and as hard as they work, most state employees don't know the true annual cost and the value of this benefit. So we're coming out with an employee benefit statement that actually shows them that. Secondly, we've redesigned the health insurance card. For almost 40 years, people carried the health insurance card around in their pocket, and it had the name Blue Cross Blue Shield on the front. The explanation of benefit they would get in the mail had Blue Cross Blue Shield. If for some reason they had overpaid a copay, the check they got had Blue Cross Blue Shield. So why wouldn't people think that Blue Cross Blue Shield is the insurer? They are not and never have been. They're the third-party administrator. So the second piece of this is that we've redesigned the state health plan card. So now it says your state health plan paid for by you and taxpayers like you. We want the participants in this plan to think as deeply about this when they pull it out of their pocket as they do one of these when they pull it out of their pocket. We think we have a shot at turning them into watchdogs and driving down the cost of health care. And then the third part of this, which I previously mentioned, was the explanation of benefit, which doesn't explain the benefit of anything. We want our consumers to know the value and the price of what they consumed in healthcare so that they can ask questions about whether they really receive those services or not. This is not the end. These are just the beginning, but we're very excited, and our participants are very excited because they do not want to get things in the mail where they don't know what it means. And we're trying to push the power away from us and give all these 740,000 participants the tools they need. And for your listeners, what does 740,000 participants mean? That is the equivalent of the U.S. employment base of Berkshire Hathaway, J.P. Morgan, and Amazon combined. We have the buying power. We're going to be taking advantage of it.
We have just a little bit of time remaining, but are there other things that you want to see the General Assembly take action on before they hit the road for the summer that would really help with this?
The number one thing is the solvency bill. You know, North Carolina, in the eyes of the rating agencies, and I'm involved in the rating agencies right now because we're getting ready to go to market with another $400 million worth of bond issuance. They get accolades for the rainy day fund. They get accolades for the unemployment trust fund. They get accolades of having budget surplus. But the two final things that need to be cured in North Carolina are the unfunded pension and health care liabilities. So there's a piece of legislation sitting in the Senate right now where we're going to have a solvency fund and be one of the first, if not the first, in the United States, where we start putting money aside for these unfunded liabilities. And I can tell you that long term, that will make a generational difference in the future of North Carolina, and it will set North Carolina on a path that any company that's thinking about expanding or relocating to our state, they're going to be asking themselves the questions, what's the unfunded liability of the other state we're thinking about going to?
State Treasurer Dale Falwell, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
A commitment to truth and transparency in government. That is the mission of Carolina Journal, and we are proud to deliver. And now, proud to tell you, the North Carolina Press Association has honored two members of our team with awards for reporting and writing. That's right, we really do deliver award-winning journalism. We shine the light on government spending, reveal the truth about boondoggles, and dig deep into programs paid for with your tax money. We keep you in the know in a way other media outlets don't. And our reach and influence are growing. Through all of our outlets, we reach more than 1 million North Carolinians each month. So make sure you're one of them. Our monthly print edition arrives in your mailbox every month. Our online daily news site, CarolinaJournal.com, has fresh stories, opinion pieces, and more. The award-winning Carolina Journal team, our reporters make government accountable to you. Call 1-866-JLF-INFO for your free subscription. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. North Carolina's Renewable Energy Investment Tax Credit Program actually ended about 2.5 years ago. But despite the fact that the program is officially over, the state actually paid out $454 million in these subsidies over the past 2 years, including $245 million during 2016 alone. So what's going on with a program that is officially dead but still costing taxpayers money? Dan Way is associate editor of Carolina Journal. He's been reporting on this story and joins us now. Dan, welcome back.
Thank you.
What is this program to begin with?
Well, it's a major subsidy program to the renewable energy industry. That's what it was. It was a 35% tax credit that's issued to entities that invest in renewable projects.
Had this been going on for a long time?
It started in 2010. The first payouts were being made in 2010. But the program actually sunset at the end of 2015.
So it's sunsetted, but yet, according to your report in Carolina Journal, it's still paying out money. So that's a head-scratcher for me. How does that work?
The Lazarus effect. So when this law was drafted, they put an unusual provision in there that allows these credits to carry forward for 5 years. So if you and I are doing our taxes, we have to claim our deductions that tax year. This allows them to use that tax credit over the course of 5 years. So if they don't use it all this year, they can roll it over to the next year, to the next year.
So if the program officially ended in December of 2015, it really won't end. We could potentially be paying things out until December of 2020?
And later than that, because the legislature then went back and created a Safe Harbor Act in 2016 for projects that were in the pipeline. But didn't get all the necessary approvals because of backlogs and getting all these things run through at the last minute. So if they had a certain amount of the project completed, they were then eligible for this Safe Harbor Act. So that added some time to it. And In the last budget year, last year, the legislature also added some renewable provisions that will extend that credit retroactively to some of these folks, even though the program is officially dead.
Pretty interesting. Now, economists will tell us that if you subsidize something, you're going to get more of it. What impact has this program had on North Carolina in terms of the renewable energy industry?
This was probably the main driver for the renewable industry. And you're right. If you give money to something, people are going to take advantage of it. Right. So it's not a big surprise. But you have to remember it's just one of many provisions, one of very many lucrative deals that the renewable industry got that helped to propel North Carolina into the number two position nationally for the amount of solar capacity installed.
So, Dan, in your reporting, you talk about some of the major recipients of the renewable energy credit. And one of them is in the energy industry, so that sort of made sense to me. The other one, however, I don't think of as an energy firm. I'm talking about Blue Cross Blue Shield of North Carolina. How is it that they would qualify for this type of tax credit?
Well, when I talked to them, they said that they actually did invest that money. So you get that 35% tax credit back. Apparently they went whole hog on this, and by law they had every right to do that. Whether or not this was wise policy for the taxpayers of North Carolina who end up filling that void is a separate question altogether. But
so we're talking about a health insurance company that made an investment then in some sort of renewable energy facility?
Right. And in the year 2017, there were 41 entities that received more than $1 million in tax credits. All but four of those were big banks and big insurance companies.
Now, that's really fascinating because I would think that it would be, Smith and Jones Electric Company or, Smith and Jones Biomass Company.
You would think that. here's the 2017.
So this is a very big report
here,
a list of those who received this.
And what you'll see is the individuals who are on here, people like you and I who might take some money and invest it, their tax credits are really small. The big players are getting the big money. They made the biggest investments. They're reaping the biggest rewards.
So. Speaking of big player, we talked about Blue Cross. What about Duke? They're in this.
Yeah, Duke. From the years 2014 to 2017, Duke and Blue Cross combined received 33% of all the tax credits issued by the state.
We're talking about Duke Energy, Duke University.
Right.
Okay, and how much again? Tell me that again.
They got 33% of all the tax credits issued. It was Blue Cross over that time got $120 million in tax credits, and Duke Energy had $117 million in tax credits from 2014 to 2017.
Well, here's something that I kind of wonder about this, Dan. If the program is officially dead as of 2.5 years ago, but we know there's been several different actions that now allow these payouts to continue for several more years, does that tell us that in the legislature there is or isn't an appetite to do this kind of thing, this kind of subsidy?
Well, it's still very much alive as a debate over there. There have been attempts by some folks to resurrect this tax. They still think it's a good idea. Other folks say, hey, we've already paid out $815 million. There's still another possible $820-some million that is outstanding that could be issued. So that's a lot of money to take out of your budget.
Typically, I know in your reporting and reporting of others as well, there tend to be arguments for this and arguments against it. And obviously, this is a public policy issue. Give us a sense of the people who support this. Why do they support it?
Well, I think there's a lot of money to be had here. The sustainable energy folks certainly are for it. They think that this is the wave of the future. And the people who would oppose it would be those who say, hey, we're giving an unfair advantage to a particular segment of the market. If they are as good as they say they are, they should live and die on their own abilities, not at the subsidy of the taxpayer.
You know, people might be thinking that, well, the Republicans are in charge of the General Assembly right now, and who knows what will happen in the November election. That possibly could change. But for now, one would think that there would be more of an appetite to end this kind of thing because of so many fiscal conservatives who've talked about reining in spending and having more respect for the taxpayer. But it manages to creep along and still be alive.
Well, even among the Republicans, you know, the renewable energy, the solar panels are a shiny bauble. It's politically and culturally popular. Not everyone understands all the intricacies of the funding. So,
but you do, which is why this is a great story for folks to read at CarolinaJournal.com. The headline is "Expired Renewable Tax Credit Program Still Paying Out Millions." Even though this program officially ended December 31st, 2015, the state of North Carolina, having paid $454 million in subsidies in the past 2 years, and $245 million in 2016 alone. We've been talking to the reporter and editor who's worked on this story. He is Dan Way with Carolina Journal. Dan, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Again, folks, you can read this story at carolinajournal.com. That's all the time we have for Carolina Journal Radio this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll join us again next week for another edition of Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.